Hey folks, this is David Silken with another episode of American History Untucked. My guest for this episode is Keith Harris. I think many of you might know Keith from the blogosphere. He blogged for a long time at Cosmic America. I learned the origin of that name in this episode today. But more recently on Keith Harris History, where he has a blog, where he has a YouTube channel, and he has a new and really innovative independent journal called The Americanist Independent, which started in July of 2014, has put out 7 issues thus far, and has done some really interesting work there with trying to connect with historians of different kinds of backgrounds and a different kind of publishing model. He's also the author of a new book called Across the Bloody Chasm, The Culture of Commemoration Among Civil War Veterans, that just came out a few months ago. And he's also working on a book at the moment on D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which is at the middle of its centennial right now. So we talk about all these things. We talk about how to interact with the public. We talk about life inside and outside of the ivory tower, and about the job market, and there's some problems with it. So here's my conversation with Keith Harris. Welcome to the show, Keith.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, David. Appreciate it.
What's the weather like in sunny Southern California?
The weather here is beautiful, as almost always. It's a little muggy this morning, but we're hovering in around 85 degrees and 85 degrees in March, which is quite nice, especially if you're a runner. If we get out on the streets, it's really nice here.
I think all the people on the East Coast want to lynch you right now.
Yes, okay. I think they do, and I've been looking at all my friends' posts on the various social media outlets, and they're all, you know, digging themselves out of feet and feet of snow. So that's unfortunate. You know, what can you do?
We can all move to California, but I think
you could. But
property values would already be more through the roof than they already are.
They're already insane, so it'd just make it that much more.
So. You know, I mentioned sort of at the top of the show that all the stuff you're doing with the book coming out recently and with the journal coming out very regularly and with the blog and all the other things that are on the website. So thank you for finding time to talk with me. I thought we'd start with talking about the journal, because we've had actually a few people who published with the journal, The Americanist Independent, who've also been on the show, Kevin Levin and Megan Kate Nelson and Liz Covart, I've all had on fairly recently. And so I've you know, seen what they've written for you. And where did the idea for having an independent journal come from?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and thanks for asking. The journal is something of a brainchild of mine that I've been working on for a couple of years. And it came out of the notion that I think that people all around the country are interested in history, and there's an informed public out there, but not all of these people are necessarily associated with academia. You know, they have, you know, their tenure track jobs and everything, but a lot of people are either students, they're entering into that field, or they're independent historians. And I thought it'd be a really good idea to give some sort of platform for all kinds of people to publish and have that experience of publishing in a scholarly journal. So my original idea was to do a straight ahead scholarly journal like that for students, for independents, for people, for promising undergraduates, for graduate students, and for independent historians to publish in that way. And then the idea kind of expanded more into a broader website that featured not only scholarly publications, but artistic endeavors, anything really that pertained to history in any way, and just put it in under different categories so people could visit the website and have that kind of experience interacting with people who wrote history for a living, or, you know, or as amateurs.
So what are the advantages, you think, for people writing, whether they're academics or whether they're normal people? Real people.
normal people. Wow, I don't know.
what's the advantage for publishing with a journal like the Americanist Independent?
Well, something like this is a lot more easily accessible than an academic journal. I think, for one, the tone of the journal is not as jam-packed with the kind of esoteric language you'll find when you read an academic publication. And not to say there's anything wrong with that, but those publications, I believe, are tailored specifically for academia and for this sort of insular community of people, of experts, of people who are versed in a very specific and particular way of looking at history. And I think that a journal like this, like mine, the Americanist Independent, is more accessible to a broader reading public that are informed, know a lot about history, and are excited to read about it and talk about it and even write about it. And this is a great platform for that. And also, it doesn't cost anything, which is nice. You know, some journals can be kind of pricey. I mean, not they're not crazy expensive, but you know, you have to pay to subscribe. And this is combining, I think, some of the great elements of scholarship and publications, traditional publications, as I like to call them, and blogging, whereas blogging is easily accessible and interactive too. You can comment, you can communicate, you can you know, expand the things that you read on the website itself, and you can distribute them all across the web through the various social media platforms that are all linked to it and everything. So there's, you know, there's that aspect of it as well. There's a communal aspect to the whole thing that you really don't find in traditional academic publishing.
Or if you do, it's in a letter to the editor that then gets published, you know,
nine
months later, and then they get a response from that, you know.
And that's really a good point. I mean, one of the things that I always found kind of tedious with academic publishing, and I've gone that route too. You know, I've published in the traditional journals, but there's a process that comes along with that, and it's the peer review, and it's the long waiting period. And so you write something, and then you may see it published in a year or so,
if you're lucky.
If you're lucky, and you know, and by the time it comes out, I mean, your information, your work may be, you know, kind of may have moved on since then, right? So, so that's one of the detriments, I think, of traditional publishing. And this, somebody submits something to me that I think is interesting, and you know, sort of a hot button issue now, or it's topical now, or anything like that. I can publish it right away and get response from it right away. And you know, and these communications can benefit not only, you know, everybody who's interested in the particular subject, but the person writing it as well, because they get instantaneous feedback. Yeah. And it's one of the great things I think about web publishing and about opening it up to the broader public is this back and forth sort of communication that you find so much in blogging. And so that's what I really wanted to do with this website, was not to make it just a simple blog. I mean, I have that too, but not to make it a simple blog, but a place where people who are interested in all kinds of history can come together and collaborate on something, and then take that and expand it elsewhere.
So what is the process if somebody wanted to submit something to the journal?
Well, it's very simple. You just go to the journal website, of course, AmericanistIndependent.com, and there's a link right there on the front page that says, if you are interested in submitting something and being on the cutting edge of historical publication, I think that's what I say, then here's the link. Click here and send it to me. This links to an email address, and they send it in, and I check it out. The peer review is essentially me. I am the editor and the editorial staff. It's all me. I do everything. And so, you know, I look at it. I offer suggestions. You know, I make some minor edits sometimes if it's necessary. And this is a small back and forth exchange with the authors, and then it goes out. When I first started publishing this last summer 2014, it was monthly. And what I found was that it was maybe a bit ambitious to to try to do this monthly. So I went the first 7 months monthly, and then I decided that it would probably be a better idea to do it quarterly. It would give me a little bit more time, since I'm the entire staff of this, a little bit more time to you know, dedicate more time to each individual author, and then publish something without quite so much pressure. That being said, of course, I still incorporate every month different things. And if you look at the website, you'll see there's plenty of tabs with all kinds of one of my favorite tabs right now is the art, music, and literature section, where people submit their original artwork. They submit musical pieces. I've got people submitting poetry, people submitting their historical fiction on there. And I can put that up as is on a monthly basis. Just the other day, I posted Wendy Allen's portraiture of Abraham Lincoln, which many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with and is quite lovely. And also a guy named Dusty Elmer, a New Yorker who plays a fantastic clawhammer banjo, Appalachian style, old time, put his music on there. You know, and this is all Americana. It's all related to American history in some way or another. And it's a great avenue for people to kind of get all sort of aspects, not just scholarship, but all types of Americana.
So what has surprised you about the who's submitting or who's reading the journal? Is it who you thought would be reading and participating, or is it
at first, yes, but you never know who is interested in history. I meet people on social media from all walks of life. I'm interested in all kinds of things. You know, I like fashion and I like fitness and I like mid-century architecture. I like all kinds of things. And I meet a lot of people, and when they find out what I do, they go, "Hey, you know, I've always been interested in American history." And all of a sudden, you know, an architect is reading. I would never have expected them to have any interest whatsoever in 19th century American history, for example. And it turns out that they've been fascinated with it all their life. And now all of a sudden I've got a new reader and we're talking about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So in some ways it's not been surprising, but then, you know, I guess the lesson to be learned here is that the public has a thirst for American history. They really do. And more so than I ever thought, you know, when I bring it up in conversation, people go, "Oh wow, I've always loved history, you know, and it's really great what you do." And they come and they check me out.
Well, and they have stories to tell sometimes that, you know, they don't have a vehicle for otherwise. Remember there was one issue, I think it was a couple issues back, that there was a guy who had a bunch of letters in his attic and
exactly,
you know, told a story about his, you know, it's a family story in some ways, but it's also, you know, a historical story, and there wasn't a vehicle for him to tell that story, at least not that he had found until he found your journal. So
that's exactly right. And these letters are actually of really historical significance. And I think you're referring to the World War II aviator, the letters submitted about the World War II aviator. And they're beautifully written letters by a person who had a gift, I think, for just writing these very evocative pieces back home to his family. They're just family letters, you know, but he talked about Pearl Harbor. He talked about the Battle of Midway. And of course, when you read the letters, you realize the person was killed in action, and it's a moving experience to read these things, and they're not published anywhere, you know. And so I was actually very fortunate and very honored to be able to publish a piece of this person's family history there.
So this is not your first sort of foray into digital history, if we can call it that. You've been blogging since, you know, for I guess more than 5 years now, really. Starting with Cosmic America and now with Keith Harris History.
Right.
What drove you to start blogging in the first place?
Well, you know, I get asked this a lot, actually. My first blogging experience, I think it was at the end of 2009 or the beginning of 2010, right in there. This was an outlet for me, really. It sort of was born of frustration when I was in graduate school because I was constantly writing and reading about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had so many other things to talk about. And so many other things that interested me, but my writing and my research was focused on Civil War veterans at the time. So, in order to have some sort of an outlet for me, just to, you know, have my word about things, and I said, well, you know, I'd start blogging. There was a few other bloggers then at the time that were doing really well, and they were sort of inspirational for me. And I was always reading those, and so I'll start doing it myself. And it started off kind of slowly, you know, and I was interested in popular culture, how history is represented in motion pictures and in literature and various other things, and also just, you know, basic commentary. I was living in Virginia at the time, and there's a lot of Civil War history that sort of reemerges there all the time through various things such as, you know, battle flag controversies and commemorative issues and various other things. And these are the kind of things that I was interested in talking about and just engaging with the public about. And that grew, and I had a knack for it. I was, you know, I enjoyed sitting down either every day or every few days and just writing a few paragraphs about what was on my mind, and it kind of took off there for a while under the name Cosmic America. And then after a couple of years of writing under Cosmic America, it sort of occurred to me that nobody really knew what that meant. So
yeah, I was always curious in reading it, what did Cosmic America,
you know,
mean?
It's kind of comes. The story is I'm a Graham Parsons fan, And he always called his music, people would say, what kind of music do you play? And he would, it was a country, is it rock, what is it? And he goes, it's cosmic American music. And I kind of started thinking about that, and he goes, well, I guess that, you know, I liked the way that sounded, and I kind of don't write about anything specifically either, so I just thought about, you know, the cosmos in America. It sounds kind of weird, but whatever. And it kind of had a nice ring to it.
Okay.
But then is, you know, so it's nothing particularly deep. It's just something
okay,
that I was
wondering if
in.
It was like a weird allusion to Whitman or something that I hadn't picked up on. And I was like, Graham Parsons works too.
I sure would like it if it was something like that, but it wasn't quite that clever. I just liked the way it sounded, and it was associated to something that I was really interested in at the time. So it worked. But then, you know, we talk a lot in social media about the idea of branding and this and that. And so I wanted to, you know, make sure that people knew that it was me, especially since I've sort of gotten a footing at this point in the blogosphere, and people recognized the Cosmic America, but I wanted them to recognize me by name. So I just changed it to the sort of boring but very definitive Keith Harris history. I want to say a couple of years ago now, maybe 3.5-4 years ago, I changed it to Keith Harris history and just switched over. And, you know, otherwise it's the same. It's more or less the same thing.
Well, one of the features that you had in Cosmic America, and I don't think you've revived it yet, but you used to have an office hours feature that you could probably do a better job describing it than I could, but that was always one of my favorite features of the blog.
You know, well, thanks for bringing that up, and that actually it sort of confirms some of the things that I've been thinking about resurrecting that, because a lot of people have mentioned the office hours segment of the old blog and what that, and I have to get it going again, and I keep meaning to do that. But one of the whole thing behind office hours was people used to ask me all these questions when I was a TA, teacher's assistant at the University of Virginia, and I'd hold my office hours and people would come to me with questions, and they would be, you know, whatever questions for whatever class I happen to be teaching. And I'd give them a few minutes on it, and they would go on their merry way, right? Well, I thought about taking that and making a video series out of it where people could submit questions to me via Twitter or via email or whatever they wanted. But any question, really, about anything. They were usually Civil War questions because that's my area of expertise. But they could be any questions about anything pertaining to American history, and I would answer in a short 2 to 3 minute video and put it on YouTube. I'd give them a little shout out, and it was kind of a nice little feature, and I live in LA, which is kind of a cool place to live, and there's lots of cool things to see here and cool restaurants and places to go. So I would like to go to an interesting spot from which to do this office hours video, and I just make a little short video.
See, that's the part that I loved about it, because you'd go to a restaurant and you'd have the questions about political parties and the Confederacy or something, and you'd be in a Chinese restaurant, and there's no, you know, particular reason for you to be in a Chinese restaurant other than you thought the food was good and the background music was interesting.
And it's funny because the people sitting around me were always going, why is this guy talking about 19th century? You know, I can just see the looks on their faces. He's talking about, you know, the Democratic Party of the 19th century was always, that kind of stuff is pretty funny. But yeah, there's cool bars and there's places around them, you know, that made for nice backdrop. So I'm glad you brought that up, because you're not the first person that has told me that I needed to get that thing going again. Because it's interesting, you know, and people...
Excuse for going to good restaurants.
It's a great excuse for going to good restaurants, and I love going to good restaurants. I wish we had even more good restaurants here, but, you know, there's plenty, I guess.
Maybe I should do that here with pubs in Edinburgh. I think we have
three
on every street corner.
No kidding. I love that idea. I think you should do it.
Yeah, they're not very well lit usually, though, for that kind of thing. But
I know. Well, but it'd still be cool. Maybe we could do like a video conference and a tag team one. That might
exactly.
be
exactly. You might have to be drinking at 10 in the morning when I'm drinking in the afternoon. But
listen, it wouldn't be the first time. But I'm not going to get into that.
Right. you and me both. So I mean, one of the things I think that, you know, very clear is you've really thought a lot about how to engage the public beyond the usual academic audience, the, you know, few hundred people who read academic books when they get published, and you know, the conversations that happens sort of at academic conferences gain sort of beyond that. Why do you think most historians are so bad at talking to people who are not within the fold?
You know, that's something that we talk about all the time, you know, with my colleagues, and why exactly is going on here. There's this weird division, And it doesn't exist with everybody, but it does exist enough to where it's significant and it's worthy of discussion, that there's this weird division between academics and either amateur historians or just people who are interested in history, you know, around the world, and that they're, you know, one is this sort of elitist group and the other is this sort of group who doesn't get it and doesn't understand, and there's this battle going back and forth. Now, see, I disagree with like that sort of artificial division. And I think one of the problems with academics is they, you know, they're like I mentioned earlier, this is sort of insular community, and they're talking to one another. They're talking to specialists in specialists' language. You know, I mean, when you go see your doctor, doctor doesn't talk to you in his specialist language. He speaks to you in plain English so that you can understand what's going on. And I've found that, at least in the United States, where I talk to most people, is that there are thousands and tens and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people out there that are all really interested in history and in speaking about it, but they don't want to be necessarily condescended, given language, any kind of condescending language or any kind of spoken down to. I mean, maybe I'm being too harsh. I don't know if that's really right, the right characterization, but you know, there's a public out there that loves to talk about history. I am an academic, I suppose. I have professional training, but I would really actually like to go and talk to those people because those people are interesting and they buy books, you know, and I have books for sale. So I want them to read them. And if I write a book that nobody can understand, not because they're stupid, but because I've written it in such, you know, specialized language that they're not going to be able to get it, you know. It's not, you know, some kind of weird academic code. I'd much rather write in a way that people can engage, and that's what I think is important right now for academics to break out of their ivory tower and reach out to the public who is just dying to get the information. They want to hear it. You can go on any social media platform and search any topic about American history, and you'll find people all over the place talking it in very vibrant ways. Mm-hmm. But academics aren't necessarily engaging. And there's some notable exceptions
to be sure. To this. Yeah.
You know, there's a good number of academics who have realized this, and who, while they're engaged in academia, they're also engaged with the public. And I think this is a wonderful thing. And you've seen this happening in greater numbers over the last several years, now that social media such as Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all these places they're here to stay. Maybe not in the exact form that they are, but the interconnectedness of the world right now is not going away, where we can speak to somebody instantaneously. I mean, you and I are speaking right now 8,000 miles apart. We're having a conversation just like, you know, we were sitting across from one another at a table. This kind of stuff is not going away, and it happens across all kinds of platforms. And I think historians who actually want to impart some sort of knowledge to a broader populace have realized this is the way to do it.
Yeah.
And they're on their blogs, they're connecting their blogs to their social media platforms, and they're sending the stuff out there to potentially millions and millions of people who are looking at it and talking about it. And so I think that I'm really, really pleased that that seems to be going more towards that direction. While there's still plenty of academics who are, you know, yeah, absolutely refusing to get involved in this and saying, you know, this is not what I'm into this for.
Yeah.
You know, but those people, I think, are making a big mistake.
Well, I mean, I think there, you know, obviously there's some people who are, you know, Luddites and don't want to do it for that reason, and some people who, mm-hmm, you know, just aren't as comfortable as engaging with the public as some other people.
But
they do good work, and I guess we have a place for them.
Sure.
You know, I think part of it is a lot of people feel like they're not rewarded for engaging with the public as the way they are with publishing journal articles and that five people read
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, you don't get tenure from talking to, you know, 10,000 people on Twitter.
Yeah.
And maybe you know, that's an interesting point that you bring up. Maybe engaging with the public should be a component to job advancement. You know, and I don't know if I'm pretty outspoken about how I feel about, you know, the traditional job market in academia.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of it, and I've gone on the record, and it's probably, you know, why I'd never get a job even if I looked for one at this point, because I'm sure I've pissed off a number of people in placement committees to do that. But you know, and this is no secret here. Everybody in academia knows the job market is absolutely horrific right now.
Yeah.
And even in the adjunct world is starting to go away. I read something recently, I think it was in Arizona, where a university just completely fired all of their adjuncts kind of on the spot. You know, it's a shame if that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think maybe there should be more ways to teach history, and the traditional tenure track college job position is not necessarily it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, I think since you brought up the blog post, I was going to, I'll, for those of you who haven't read this, this is a blog post you had from January of, mm-hmm. of last year, Reject the Academic Job Market. And I'll just read the key passage. So I call for a revolutionary measure, reject the job market, do not apply, do not accept an adjunct position unless, of course, you enjoy earning $24,000 a year. And most important, do not try to be the catalyst of change within the existing institution. There comes a time when we must admit that trying to fix a broken system is along the lines of rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic, so don't bother.
Yeah, those are strong words, aren't they? And I mean every one of them. It's, people ask me all the time about what they're going to do with their PhDs, you know, advanced graduate students, or people just entering graduate school. And the old way of looking at things was, you know, you go through the motions, just like I did, just like everybody does. You go on the job market and you do the whole thing and you get a job and, you know, life goes on merrily as it goes. But that's just not the case anymore. And I was on the job. I mean, I'll admit I was on the job market for several years, 3 years, and I took an adjunct position. The adjunct position was tantamount to slave labor in a sense. You know, I think if I added everything up, I mean, I don't have precise numbers, but I was making well below minimum wage.
Sure.
You know, and I didn't even get a parking space, you know, and they, you know, I did get a nice office with a view, but I had to share with somebody. But other than that, I didn't even get a parking space. And it was like, you know, is this.
And in LA, a parking space is important.
Oh, in LA, a parking space is extraordinarily important. I mean, I was in Riverside, but that's close enough. You know, and the thing is what confuses me and what I don't understand is why the system is set up to produce people to go into the job market, the traditional job market, when there just are no jobs to be had. You know, and it's the academia or the system, if you want to call it the system. I know it sounds very Orwellian, but the system is pumping out PhDs by the thousands every year, right? And doesn't seem to be letting up whatsoever. And these people who go on these, some are on fellowships, of course, but some spend an enormous sum of money to get these degrees and mm-hmm. the best that they can expect. And this is the very best. And of course, there are exceptions. You know, I went to a great school, University of Virginia, to get my PhD, and a lot of my classmates went on to get pretty decent jobs. Some of them did, some of them didn't, you know? Mm-hmm. But And without sounding bitter, now I'll admit that I was bitter about this for a couple of years, but I've gotten over my bitterness. And what I've seen is that instead of fixing a broken system, right, I think the system just needs to people just need to step aside from that and figure out what else they can do. Because it's at the point of trying to tinker with it, there's a lot of people that are advocating for adjunct unions and mm-hmm. various other things. So they get a few $100 more a semester.
And a parking spot.
And a parking spot. Okay, well, that's not really helping much when you're making, you know, $20,000 a year as an adjunct. That's living below poverty level. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's ridiculous. So fixing that system, I don't know. Why bother fixing the system, really? I just don't see where that would be, or even trying. Mm-hmm. I think completely wiping the slate clean and starting over is probably a good way to go. The tenure system could be a thing of the past. It's an archaic system. And I don't know. One of the problems I think with it is it just completely lets people off the hook in terms of accountability. Mm-hmm. You know, a tenured professor can do just as well or just as poorly as, you know, anyone. And well, there you go. There is no accountability system. They don't have to produce necessarily anything. And I think that that's kind of ridiculous. And I also think that perhaps maybe not so many PhDs should be produced every single year.
Yeah.
You know, you glut the market with a product, essentially, mm-hmm. and that product's value drops to next to nothing very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you have that, we've got a gigantic problem. The guy behind me in line at the post office yesterday, I was just talking to my wife about this, they had a stack of envelopes in his hand. I'm sure they were all job applications. And he was on the phone with a friend talking about the situation as an adjunct. You know, and I just kind of smiled to myself. I wanted to, you know, turn around and say, hey, it's going to be okay. You just got to figure something else out. But, you know, I'll let him figure that out for himself.
Well, I think, you know, I think you've identified lots of the problems with the whole thing. I mean, the the overproduction of PhDs has been going on for so long. And, you know, there's lots of reasons why that happens. I think people, you know,
and get
rewarded by their universities for producing more PhDs. So they tell us get twice as many PhDs candidates as you did, you know, 10 years ago.
Sure. And I'm oversimplifying.
I know it's a, you know, but, you know, it's just, you know, and who gets a job and who doesn't get a job. I've realized this, the more I think about it, it's in part based on how good the work they do, but it's mostly based on, you know, luck and happenstance as much as it is anything else.
It's an arbitrary and it's a capricious, you know, environment, and you go into it with, any number of things can happen. I mean, I did all the stuff that I was supposed to do when I was in graduate school, and I really want to stress that I don't look, you know, necessarily at universities as the bad guy. You know, I just think that there's a situation that has evolved over the last, you know, several decades where there is a significant problem in terms of higher education, and something just needs to be drastically changed, not tinkered with, but drastically changed.
Well, I think, you know, increasingly there are lots of people who are taking their PhDs, you know, and doing other things with it, and not thinking of themselves as a failure for making that choice.
Oh, sure.
You know, and which I think is was a wonderful thing, because it, you know, it used to be not that long ago, if you didn't get a tenure track job, then you had somehow failed. And now if you end up writing for other venues, or if you end up, you know, podcasting, if you end up doing some other kinds of history in other areas, you know, you're still making good use of your degree, and you're still a legitimate scholar, even if you're not, you know, producing other PhDs.
Well, right, and I'm glad that you phrased it that way, because this idea of legitimacy, I think, is troubling to a lot of people if you don't have that university job, and there's this sort of lack of legitimacy, I think, that still kind of hovers around like a specter over this, over what we do as historians. And you know, I mean, I'm a scholar, I suppose, if you want to call it something, you know, but I don't have that particular kind of job, but I still think of myself as the same way I would if I did teach in a university. You know, I have different teaching outlets that I do, of course. I teach privately here in Los Angeles. But as far as working on my scholarship, I do the same thing that I would had if I were working in a university. I'm just not, I'm not funded. I have to pay for it myself, which is, you know, a bit of a problem, but still, I mean, you do what you have to do, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, there's all kinds of avenues that you can go into using a history PhD. I mean, the skills that you learn in graduate school can sort of bleed out into other areas as well. I mean, you know, we become experts at research, we become experts at writing, we become experts at a lot of things when we're in graduate school, and that can work in lots of areas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, I remember the OAH and the AHA were talking about Plan B, you know, and about things you could do with a PhD besides becoming an academic. And I think increasingly lots of people are saying, well, that's not necessarily a backup plan. My primary intent is getting a PhD and then doing something besides being a, you know, academic in the traditional mold. And I think that's good for the profession, I think.
I think that's fantastic for the profession. And I think that the way that that was phrased, that not being a secondary move, is the way to look at this now. And the traditional path that one takes when they get a PhD, I think that is what needs to be the sort of profound, significant change in all of this. And I think when that actually takes hold, and which is what this, my little mini manifesto, is what I'm calling for, to reject this academic job market, which is where we started with this, was to don't look at the academic job market, unless of course you want to, but I mean, don't look at that as the only thing. Have a plan A, and, you know, use that as maybe a secondary plan, or maybe not even a plan at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're going to be getting into is this sort of, this interview process that is, inexplicable in so many ways.
No, it's the one of the things I've loved about coming over to the UK is that the interview process here is much more straightforward and much less expensive.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, the whole, you know, interview with the AHA thing is, I think, a dinosaur, yeah, to be honest with you. And I would love to see universities completely just get rid of that. And what it just seems ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of them are, but mostly so they can save themselves money by not sending four faculty members to New York and
JP. No kidding. No kidding.
But and there's no reason why you should do that if you're going for a half hour interview anyway.
Yeah, and when we have the technology set up where you don't need to do that, and you can hit conference call like we're doing now very easily, I think the interview process is absurd.
So we've been talking about sort of new ways of doing history. You've actually recently published a book, which I guess is the old way of doing history.
Yes, that's my last hurrah as a traditional academic scholar. And again, I'll admit, I got hung up on this idea of legitimacy. Now, I love Louisiana State University Press. They are wonderful people. I loved working with them. It was fantastic. They were great to work with. But I probably won't publish with an academic press again, just because I think, you know, I probably could reach more people if I publish with a commercial press. I'm not sure. But this book, Across the Bloody Chasm, that you talked about, is actually my PhD dissertation, greatly revised. That went through a number of changes after I got the PhD and then finally materialized in print form last November. And I'm very pleased with it.
So, you know, the book is about the memory of the Civil War and about the role of veterans in that memory. And I think most people listening to this podcast are you know, somewhat familiar with all the scholarship that's come out, I guess, since... But Blight's Race and Reunion was 2001, something like that?
2000 or 2001.
Yeah. So what for those of you who haven't had, for the people listening who haven't had a chance to read it yet, what do you think is the element to this story that Across the Bloody Chasm adds to what we know about how Americans in the late 19th and early 20th century thought about what the war meant and how to make sense of it?
Okay, cool. Well, and it's a good question. Thanks for asking. As I'm sure you all know, those of you who have read Blight, and pretty much everybody has by now, yeah, who's interested in Civil War memory, he is one of the pillars of Civil War memory now. But the book's coming up now in 15, 16 years old, yeah, and the main conclusion that Blight draws in that book is that memory is sort of whitewashed. Civil War memory was whitewashed by the 1880s, the 1890s, and I think I don't remember his exact phrasing, but I can paraphrase. What he says is that reconciliationists and white supremacists came together and crafted a Civil War memory on Southern terms, and that's his general conclusion there. And every kind of commemorative effort, every kind of ceremony that had to do with celebrating the Civil War, pretty much excised all of the divisive issues about the war, slavery, emancipation, particularly. And he says that because of Northern veterans and Southern veterans shared racism, they were pretty eager and willing to write black people out of the war, to write the issues of slavery out of the war, and then celebrate things like virtue, bravery under fire, fortitude, Americanness, dedication to cause, these kind of American virtues that we can all relate to, right? That's pretty much his conclusion. Mm-hmm. I imagine you'd agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's okay. What he says.
Okay, so I was reading, you know, this goes way back to about the same time that book came out when I was an undergraduate at UCLA. I went with Joan Waugh's class to Gettysburg for our sort of travel study program over the summer. And as I was a junior at UCLA, and I was going through the archives there, and I kept coming across Union veterans mostly, because it's Gettysburg, and that's sure. Most of the files there are most of the monuments there are Union veterans. Most of the files there are from Union veterans. And I was going through the files, and I kept noticing over and over again that the dedication ceremonies themselves, the speeches that took place at these ceremonies, were filled with this bitter, vituperative language that condemned the Confederacy and their cause and celebrated the Union cause not only as the preservation of the country, but as this great moral effort to destroy the institution of slavery. And I went, this doesn't sound anything at all like David Blight. Wait a second. How could he have missed this? You know? And I kept reading and I kept reading. And sure enough, and they go on. They talk on, sorry, I lost my headphones here. They talk on and on and on about Civil War issues from the 1860s, things like rebellion and treason. And they're very angry about the celebrations that are coming out of the South over Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee. They seem to despise slavery. Of course, they're racist, right?
Yeah.
But they have this sense of moralizing self-righteousness that sort of hovers over all of their speeches, as if they have done something good against something evil. Now, that didn't sound very much at all like dismissing the Civil War issues or writing things off or just talking about courage. They talk about all those things too, but they always say, the Union veterans do, they always say, yeah, our opponents were brave, but they were fighting for the worst cause that you could possibly imagine, the cause of slavery and the cause of treason. And these are awful things, and we should not celebrate them for that. Don't forget that, right? Mm-hmm. And they kept saying this, and they kept saying it into the 20th century. And here I am, I keep reading, and I'm reading stuff in the 1930s when these veterans are all extremely old at this point, and they're saying the same thing.
Yeah.
So this doesn't go away.
Whereas Blight has them sort of shaking hands and dying together at Gettysburg in 1913.
Sure, sure. Blight and Gaines Foster before him and a whole bunch of other people say the same kind of thing. They say this idea that, right after the war, there was the Bloody Shirt guys and there was the unreconstructed rebels. And, you know, and over time and very quickly that faded, right? I believe that, I can't remember who it is exactly, that said that, you know, the rebel yells, for example, had faded by the turn of the century. When I read that about the Union veterans, I started looking at the Confederate veterans as well, and they're saying very similar things, right? They're saying things about tyranny, and they're saying things about oppression, and they're saying all these types of things. It didn't sound very much like they were getting over the war at all, right? Now, what I found particularly interesting is that they, at the same time that they were doing all this, they were calling for widespread reconciliation. And so I'm looking at, they seem like opposite. What they're saying is opposing. They're saying let's reconcile, and then they're turning around and talking about a bunch of stuff that doesn't sound very reconciliationist at all. And it got me wondering, how on earth can they possibly be doing this? And I think the main point of my book is that they're perfectly willing to reconcile, both Northerners and Southerners, so long as, provided that the for their former opponents acknowledge the fact that they were wrong. And of course that's not going to happen.
Happened, sure.
Right? And so what I think they're really reconciling is this notion of sort of former unity that stems back to the founding generation. And they can look back and they can say, once upon a time, we were one country, right? And one side or the other got off track. And once they realize that they're the ones that got off track, and come back to the original intentions, whatever those were, of the founding generation. Now, both sides perceive those in different ways, of course. But once they get back on track, then we can rejoin hands like the former Union that they were, the other side, of course, acknowledging that they were wrong. Now, the other side, of course, never acknowledges that they're wrong and still really hasn't.
Well, I think, you know, you started this a long time ago, but it seems like a lot of the scholarship is you know, seeming to agree with your conclusions.
Yeah, there's a number of people out right now. Barbara Gannon, for one, Donald Schaefer. They both write about African-American veterans.
Sure.
Carrie Janey's just published a book about Civil War memory that talks about some of these things. And there's a number of other people that have come to similar conclusions. One of the problems, I think, with the literature, though, is what they tend to do is they put people in sort of clearly delineated groups. These veterans in clearly delineated groups, and we'll take the Union veterans for example. And what they'll do is they'll take a group that was at one point looked at as reconciliationists, and they'll make that group smaller, and they'll take some of those people out of that group, and they'll put them in the non-reconciliationist group. And I think what that's doing is it's dividing people into categories that don't really have any fluidity between the two. And you're just making one group of people that are still angry about the war, and there are now fewer people that are more willing to reconcile. Now, I think that across the board, pretty much everybody was willing to reconcile. That's the big difference, I think, in my, with my book from the rest of the literature is I believe that that notion of reconciliation was widespread across the country on both sides, of people perfectly happy to reconcile. It's just they did so with
some caveats attached to it.
With a number of caveats, exactly.
So you got all the journal going on and the blog and the website and all this stuff, and I know you're doing lots to promote the new book, which everyone should get a copy and read. But I know you're working on something else that you're hoping to get out, at least within this calendar year, for the anniversary. Do you want to tell me about...
Are you referring to the Birth of a Nation
Birth
stuff?
Birth of a Nation stuff, yeah.
Okay, great.
I saw on the blog that you had at least were working on that. And
yes, I am deep into working on this book now about the Birth of a Nation. The working title of this book is called, it's called An American Racist. And the subtitle, this of course working, is D.W. Griffith and the Making of the Birth of a Nation. The film, The Birth of a Nation, as everybody knows, of course, is based on the Thomas Dixon Reconstruction trilogy, the Klansman, the one book out of the Reconstruction trilogy that he wrote, The Klansman, is mostly based on that. And the film, as we all know, was extraordinarily controversial. It's extremely racist. It came out in 1915, 100 years ago. Its premiere was right here in Los Angeles, the Clunes Auditorium, in February 1915. So we've just now passed the centennial of the premiere of that film. And it outraged.
I take it they didn't have a second showing for the 100th anniversary.
No, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because I was thinking about, I wanted to put something together, but I was a little bit I didn't have the time to get something together. I still may this year. We'll see what I can do. But I'm very interested to see how a screening of that film would go over now, even if it was couched in sort of educational terms. As to come see this film so we can get a glimpse of what it was like in 1915 in motion pictures and, you know, have a panel discussion afterwards or something like that.
And somebody to play the organ.
Yes, and someone to play the Wagner score of that film. You know, Ride of the Valkyries in there was very, very exciting stuff. But anyway, so we know that the film was extraordinarily controversial. We know that the NAACP, for example, had a heated protest against that film because it depicted African-Americans as beastly and rapists, and it depicted African-American soldiers as hell-bent on destroying the South and various other things. And of course, some Union veterans were against it too because they thought it portrayed the Union cause as less than noble. And so there's a controversy of the film after its premiere. Now, a lot of modern scholars tend to look at that movie and look at it only in its controversial the post-initial screening controversy and what that means in terms of its racism. And oftentimes I think that both Thomas Dixon and D.W. Griffith, are the film's director, are dismissed as sort of these kind of crackpot racists who are determined to use this as some sort of propaganda to position white America against black America. Now, they might have had some of those ideas, but what I think hasn't been discussed yet thoroughly with any kind of scholarly publishing is the themes that these guys drew from in making their first the novels and then the film, and just how deeply embedded racism was in all of American culture. And I wouldn't think of like making an excuse for these guys or letting them off the hook for their racism. You, nobody should. But I think that we should understand that these guys are writing out of particular genres. And when D.W. Griffith made this film, he's reflecting what I think is a pretty typical understanding of what was going on both North and South when it came to looking at that war. And that's how people, I think, really thought of it. And this is a reflection. So he is thinking he's writing history, and I think a lot of people are agreeing with him. Mm-hmm. So if you draw from all the various the themes in literature and theme and other kind of, you know, cultural forms, including, by the way, scholarship, you know, you come to the conclusion that is the Birth of a Nation, the film. And it was widely embraced around the country as a historical document. And D.W. Griffith himself thought of, I guess he sort of anticipated YouTube in a lot of ways. He thought that once upon a time in the future, you would be able to go to some sort of library or something like that and say, I want to learn about Reconstruction history. And they would pull out the Birth of a Nation and say, here you go. Here's Reconstruction history for you. And, you know, students would go home, watch the film, and then they would know about Reconstruction history. Wouldn't have to read a book because there it is. He was writing history, he thought. Not, you know, and it was from a Southern perspective, and he admitted that. He has he had roots in the South and in the Confederacy, and he had something at stake here. But it was history to him, and if you read his interviews, he thought that he was being as unbiased as possible in giving a true account of what happened in Reconstruction. It's absolutely fascinating. Yeah. You know? And I think scholars tend to sort of write that off. You know, whenever you read about the Birth of a Nation, you'll go, well, T.W. Griffith was a genius when it came to filmmaking because he had all these technological innovations, and he really set the standard for the epic sweeping motion picture that we all know today, right? And he was the first one to do this. Motion pictures were 15 minutes long before, well, at least in the United States, before this came out. And here he comes out with a three-hour film that was in some ways kind of like a documentary, at least from his perspective and from people who were watching it. And so he sort of set the standard there. So yeah, he gets dismissed as just being kind of a fringe nut job.
Yeah. Well, I show it to students and they think like, they can't imagine anybody thinking this was, you know, good history, but but then when you contextualize it with what people are writing, you know, what academics are writing in 1915, it seems, you know, mm-hmm. Par for the course.
And I think if you look at that film scene by scene, and if you read Thomas Dixon's novels that the film on which the film is based, and if you look at the film scene by scene, and if you get behind the decisions that were made in those films in terms of casting, in terms of how things are shot and various other things, you really begin to see a sort of standard understanding of the United States history come very clear. I mean, for example, D.W. Griffith, the black characters in D.W., at least the main ones, mm-hmm. the main black characters in Birth of a Nation aren't black at all. They're white people.
Sure.
Now, what was the decision behind doing that? You know, you go, well, that's odd. Why wouldn't he just hire black actors? There are plenty of black actors in the film. They just don't have any, they don't have the main parts. Well, if you read Lillian Gish's testimony, she was the principal female actress in that film. If you read Lillian Gish's testimony and a few of the other actors and D.W. Griffith's testimony himself, is that it would have been awkward to have black people. This is sort of his attitude. It would have been awkward to have Lillian Gish, this sort of young white girl, on the same set as a black man. That would have been uncomfortable for not only him, but for the actor, for the actress, for everyone. And so he made those kinds of decisions. And this is just reflecting early 20th century notions of who should stand on a stage with somebody, you know?
Yeah.
And nobody really ever talks about that. They talk about the controversy that happened after the film. They look at it as racist. It is a racist document, no question. And then they look at the controversy that happened once the film debuted. They don't really get into the details of why it is racist. And that's what I want to know, why we think of that as a racist film, why we think of D.W. Griffith as a racist person. But because by all accounts, he thought of himself as a progressive. You know, he thought he was doing...
Woodrow Wilson, who is quoted in the film.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, he's quoted extensively in the film from his massive American history. I mean, some people know, some people don't, that, you know, Woodrow Wilson was something of a scholar before he became a politician. And, you know, he wrote this massive United States history, and D.W. Griffith uses that extensively. I think the quote that we all know about history with lightning that Wilson purportedly said after he saw the screening at the White House. That may be apocryphal. We're not sure if that.
Really, it's good advertising copy.
Fantastic advertising copy, and you know, you see that emerge later on as when they're promoting the film later on in the 20th century, is that Wilson said this, but he probably never did. But the important thing is that it was screened in the White House, and everybody knew that, so that gave it some legitimacy there. But yeah, I really want to know what it is about this movie that makes it what it is, why they made the decisions that they made. And it's not just, you know, simple ham-handed racism. You know, there's a lot of baggage that goes along with this. There's a lot of interesting things that go along with making this film. So I want to look at D.W. Griffith himself, and I want to look at the decisions he made when he was, they didn't really write screenplays back then. They wrote scenarios, which so Griffith would write on a piece of paper, today I'm going to, you know, do this, this, and this. And they would go and they would start shooting, and you know, there's no dialogue.
Well,
so
obviously, yeah, I mean, you don't have to write dialogue, so you don't have to do any of that. You just have to.
Right. It makes it a little bit easier. I mean, So yeah, they wrote scenarios back then, not scripts or screenplays or anything. But and unfortunately, there isn't one single document that has all of this together.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what you put together. So this is going to be a book, but not with an academic press, then? Or
I don't think so. No. I mean, I'm looking on looking at commercial presses now. I should have a manuscript ready to go, hopefully by this summer. And okay. You know, the process, of course, is a little bit isn't quite as speedy as I would like. But you know, hopefully by next year, sometime that book will be ready to go. We'll see.
Well, maybe you can cover all the stuff about how people have celebrated or not celebrated the centennial of arguably one of the most important films in American history, for both in cinema and its impact on.
Strangely, you don't see much about it, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, strangely. I mean, seeing that's such an important milestone in motion picture history, you don't really see all that much about it.
Well, I know they do showings. I don't remember what cemetery it is. Maybe it's Hollywood Cemetery, where they do showings on the side of a mausoleum in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's the Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Yeah, maybe you should get them to do a showing of Birth of a Nation.
I'm not sure if Hollywood's ready for that. I don't know how that would go over. They usually show things like The Breakfast Club.
Tell them to expand their horizons by a century.
Right where they show that now, Douglas Fairbanks wasn't in that film, but he was a contemporary of D.W. Griffith and some of the and Lillian Gish and some of the other big stars, Henry Wathol and some of the big stars in that film. He's buried right next to where they show those films. His big, it's not really a mausoleum. It's a gigantic monument to Douglas Fairbanks is right there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and Cecil B. DeMille is buried close by too.
Well, I think it's even more appropriate. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Keith, it was really great having you on the show and talking to you about all these things you're involved in. It sounds like you're 10 times busier than anybody else I know. So
for a guy who's not, doesn't have a job, I'm extraordinary.
Well, thanks again for being on the show.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
So that was my conversation with Keith Harris. I will put links to his webpage and where you can see the Americanist Independent. And I'll post a link to one of the old Office Hours segments of him getting questions from the internet and answering them in the context of a fashionable Los Angeles restaurant. And I'll also put links there to his book, which you should get a copy of. It's really an interesting sort of take on how we should understand memory and forgiveness among veterans in the Civil War. And if anyone knows, by the way, of a showing of Birth of a Nation that's happening for the centennial of that film, please let either Keith or myself know about that, because I'd be really interested to see if anybody is going to celebrate or recognize that particular anniversary with a public showing. As always, you can come visit the show's website, AmericanHistoryUntucked.blogspot.com. And you can check us out on Twitter and Facebook and iTunes and all the other kinds of places that one would expect to look for podcasts. Until next time, I'm David Silkenet.